From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I talk with reporter Michael Bamberger. He's written an insider's perspective on the world of golf based on his experiences as a caddy on the Pro Golf Tour. Also today, I speak with comic Graham Chapman. He was one of the founding members of the British comedy group Monty Python's Flying Circus. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Whitney, the follow-up to Whitney Houston's chart-topping first album. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Full Metal Jacket, Stanley Kubrick's view of the Vietnam War. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is sports writer Michael Bamberger. In 1985, Bamberger was working as a reporter on Martha's Vineyard when he took 6 months off to work as a caddy on the Pro Golf Tour. He's written an account of his experiences titled The Green Road Home. In it, he explains that the caddy is not only a two-legged beast of burden, but also an amateur psychiatrist to athletes who are notoriously superstitious. Professional golfers have no contracts or coaches or teammates to carry them through slumps, so frequently the caddy becomes their confidant. As golfer Brad Faxon told him, carrying the bags is the easy stuff. Michael Bamberger has since resumed his career in journalism and now writes for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
Well, not all of us have the dream of dropping everything to go on the road with a pro golf tour and caddy, and I wonder why that was your dream.
Well, two reasons. One, a great love and affection for the game of golf and a real desire to see it in a way that no golf fan can. And maybe more important, at that point, my first job after college was on the Martha's Vineyard Gazette, and which is an island 6 miles off the southeast coast of Massachusetts, and it's a very quiet place. And after 2 years of being sort of 2.5 years of being sort of locked on this island, nothing seemed more inviting than traveling nilly willy about the country, seeing towns like Hattiesburg, Mississippi, and Dublin, Ohio, and getting to see some of the country and some of the world.
I sometimes wonder why there still are caddies. So many golfers drive around now on those little carts, and you put the bag on the cart. Why are there still caddies when you don't have to lug around the bag anymore?
Well, most traditional players would much rather walk a golf course than have the noisy golf carts trailing behind them. And it's a way you can the pleasures of golf are so much more magnified when walking a golf course than when in a cart, and those pleasures are slightly diminished when you have to carry your own bag. So the really ideal situation is to have someone carry your bag for you and just take clubs from him as needed.
Now, we know that there's more to caddying than carry bags. Let's go through some of the things you've had to do, some of the services you've performed for the golfers that you've caddied for. Do you have to act like a psychologist to the golfer whose bag you're carrying?
Yeah, there are times when you definitely have to. Although a psychologist is always invited to talk, a caddy has to know when to talk and when not to talk. That's perhaps the most critical thing. When he talks, he has to know precisely what to say and how it's going to respond. And when he's silent, sometimes a golfer will need a period just to be steamed about something in silence, or just stir or stew about something in silence, and the caddy has to know when his golfer's in that mood too.
Well, you mentioned in your book that a caddy will know just when and just how to say "knock it in," and if the golfer makes it, that the caddy's in on that stroke and is given some credit for it.
Yeah, that's right. Perfectly with a deep and firm voice and spoken with eye-to-eye contact, square in the hole.
Perhaps more than any other sport, there's so much concentration involved in golf, and the golfer might spend a full minute just sizing up the ball and lining it up before actually taking the stroke. What's expected of the caddy during that period? Are you supposed to be quiet or focusing your thoughts?
The principal idea is that a golfer in tournament golf spends about 7 hours in a day performing his job. He gets to the golf course, he hits balls, He practices putting. He plays a round of golf that takes 4 hours. Then after his round, he goes and hits more balls. And all total, that's at least 7 hours, and sometimes 8 or 9 for some of the players. And during the course of an 8 or 9 hour workday, there are going to be an enormous number of distractions. The key thing for a caddy to do is to be able to permit his player to focus solely on the job at hand, that is, to whack golf balls with as much precision as possible at distant pins. And for a caddy to do his job right, not only does he have to know precisely how far a ball is from a pin in any given moment, and know the direction of the breeze and how it's going to affect the ball, and what obstacles are involved in an ensuing shot, but he has to be able to do sundry other things, like knowing to take a banana out of a player's golf bag because he senses that his player is becoming hungry, knowing when a player is going to want to see his scorecard to write down scores, knowing when to take out rain gear, when to take an umbrella. And not only must he take out the umbrella at the right time, he must take umbrella the right way, because golfers are incredibly finicky people, and they want things just so. And the player, the caddy, has to be extremely fastidious to these very detail-oriented people.
Does it ever feel demeaning to be in that role?
It could feel demeaning, and it would seem demeaning to the uninitiated, but it's so inherently understood that this is what a caddy does. Tour caddies have that perspective, so it's really not demeaning. But it's interesting that the roles are really quite different on the men's golf tour and on the women's golf tour. On the men's golf tour, it's very much understood that the caddy is subservient, that the caddy does essentially whatever he feels that his player wants him to do. On the women's tour, it's quite opposite. One of the number one problems the women have on the tour is that they feel that their caddies take over their games for them, that the caddy becomes sort of this general figure, while the player is a mere pawn, just executing the shots as the caddy commands her to. And there are sometimes situations where a player will hit a shot in a way that the caddy did not want her to, and the caddy will subsequently not talk to the player for 3 holes because he's so angry. And that's, of course, quite the reverse of what you see on the men's tour. When a player gets upset when a male player gets upset at his caddy, he's likely not to talk to him for a week.
So you think that the men who caddy for women pull rank by virtue of their gender over the women that
they're
caddying for?
Their gender and their
for.
Physical size. Yeah, I think that's true.
Well, how come there aren't women caddies on the women's tours? I'm sure there are many women who want to get close to the golfers.
Yeah, you see that increasingly.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Bamberger, who's written a journal of his 6 months on the road with the pro golf tour as a caddy, and it's called The Green Road Home. Golfers don't have contracts, they don't belong to a team, and their whole income depends on winning while they're on the tour. Otherwise, they don't make any money. Do you think they're more neurotic than other athletes because of that? That maybe every stroke that they take counts more for them because their livelihood is dependent
That's
on
very
it.
True. Every stroke does count more. In fact, almost every professional golfer I've ever met lives his entire life by one credo, and that is every time he has an opportunity to hit a golf ball, it is the only chance he will have to hit that golf ball in his entire life. It's not like baseball where if you can foul off 3 in a row and wait for your pitch. If the pitch is not a good one, wait for the next one. In golf, the ball sits on the fairway or in a bunker or in the rough or on the putting green or on the tee, and this is it. This is your one sole chance to perform majesty with this shot, and either you're going to do it right or you're going to suffer for it. Moreover, it's the most precarious of livelihoods of all the professional sports, I think, because, as you say, there are no contracts at all. It is completely week to week, and there's no job security of any sort. There's no pensions. There are no benefits. When you don't work, you don't get paid. Typically, in a typical tournament, the field is comprised of 144 golfers. Only half of that field is even going to play for any part of that purse. Halfway through the tournament, 177 of these golfers or so are going to be eliminated from the tournament, and they'll just have to move 200 miles down to the next stop down the road and hope that their fortune is better there. And by the same token, that's one of the things that makes caddying so fascinating, is that the caddy lives week to week on the hope that next week will be the week that his player is really going to, that everything's really going to come together, because the caddy, of course, is paid in part based on the performance of his player. He gets a percentage, typically about 5% of his player's winnings. So there's this eternal optimism that keeps caddies and golfers going from week to week, that next week is going to be the week that my golfer's game, my player's game is going to change.
Did you meet a lot of golfers who had to give up golf because they weren't winning any tournaments and they weren't making any money?
Yeah, it's really capitalism at its best. If you can't make a living out there, no one's going to carry you for you, and you're going to be gone. One of the guys I became closest with out there was a fellow named Billy Britton, who had played the tour with some success for about 4 years, and then in 1985, suddenly he had lost his game completely. He made $6,000 on the course in 1985. 1986, he spent working at a club in Westchester County, got his game back, and this year he's back on the tour, making a living. It's a very fickle game.
You actually lost money the 6 months that you were caddying.
Yeah, that's not that uncommon, though. But in that sense, I didn't live like an absolute... typical caddies are extremely frugal. I wouldn't have done some of the things that I did. I flew over to England for the British Open, went to the Dutch Open, went to the Canadian Open. If I was in New Orleans 1 week and wanted to be in Las Vegas the next for a tournament there, some caddies might have skipped that tournament because it's such an expense to fly out there or take a bus out there. But I did it because that's part of what I wanted to do.
You were an unknown when you first tried to join the Pro Golf Tour. How do you get noticed so that you can hook up with a pro golfer and caddy for him?
It's a difficult matter, becoming known as a caddy, and there's no real one way to do it. I did it in a sort of artificial way. I wrote a letter to a player and expressed to him exactly what I wanted to do. A fellow named Brad Faxon, and he invited me to. He gave me a 1 week tryout, and that's all it proved to be, is 1 week, because he fired me at the end of that week. So incompetent was I as a caddy. But it's a difficult, the caddy ranks are difficult ones to break into.
What did you do so badly that he fired you?
I did essentially nothing right. I mean, as Brad put it, there are two things caddies have to do. There's a list of tangibles, like knowing the yardage, knowing the wind direction, knowing the structure of the hole. I was bad enough at that. And then there's a list of intangibles, some of which we discussed before, like knowing when to bring out a banana, knowing when to bring out a new golf ball, knowing what to say when. And I had no experience at that whatsoever. And it was really that week with Brad was, I hope, makes for entertaining reading, because it was misery going through it. But I think I learned a lot in that first week out there with him.
One of the pros that you work with said that a caddy can't do anything to help him, but sure can hurt him. Well, that's a discouraging attitude.
That was from a curmudgeon player, though. Not all players take that view. That particular player that you mentioned typically has his daughter working for him, and the reason that he likes to have his daughter working for him is that she knows absolutely nothing about golf and doesn't speak for the entire time they are out on the golf course. But that's an old-fashioned view and not found too typically.
So you got fired from your first week of caddying. How did you reestablish yourself?
Only in my mind, because I so much wanted to do it. I knew that if there was a will, there was a way, and I knew I had learned a lot in the course of that week. The real tragedies that performed as a caddy, I did early in the week. By the end of that first week, I developed some small level of competence. So in my heart, I knew that the slope was still up.
This is great. You were doing this as a lark. You know, you left your job reporting so that you could follow your real love around the game of golf. And your first week, you were a failure. You must have felt miserable. Were you able to not worry about it too much, since this was, after all, supposed to be fun?
No, I was panicking. I had so much wanted to do it, and I had invested a considerable amount of energy into making it happen. And I was quite worried after the first week.
Golfers are famous for their polyester wear, or as you say, they euphemistically call it tour wear?
Tour wear, right.
Yeah. Do the caddies wear that too?
Caddies get the hand-me-downs from the players. Players are handed lavish and ridiculous amounts of free goods, particularly in the clothing department. Izod shirts with alligators about twice the size of the alligator that you would find in a typical store. Known as TV alligators, so they show up so broadly on TV, and they get much more than they can use, and caddies are usually the recipients of these extra free clothing.
We're going to talk more about golf in a few seconds. My guest is Michael Bamberger, the author of a new book called The Green Road Home, A Caddy's Journal of Life on the Pro Golf Tour. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Michael Bamberger is my guest. He's a sports writer. We're discussing golf, which is the subject of his new book, The Green Road Home, which is based on his 6 months caddying on the Pro Golf Tour. You know, I never had a sense before your book that there's this itinerant culture that follows the Pro Golf Tour around. It includes caddies, and it also includes the golf enthusiasts who will follow the tour around.
People are really maniacal for the game of golf, and you can't really sense that if you're not a golfer yourself, but once you get inside golf culture a little bit, it becomes pretty evident.
That's a really interesting thing, because so many people outside of golf think that it has to be the most boring sport. For outsiders, it's really difficult to understand the passion that people have for golf.
That's true.
Did you run into that with your friends who maybe didn't understand why you were doing this?
Yeah.
Okay. It's interesting that the people who are passionate about golf tend to be older people, older men.
Yeah. Well, and no, not really. How many people in this country do you think play golf?
I don't know.
Take a guess.
Oh, I couldn't. I have no sense of numbers. How many?
How many people are there in the country?
See, this is like Dick Cavett taking his general knowledge exam and failing. I have no idea.
Well, I think there are about 250 million people in the country. I'm not sure about that. But I do know there are 17 million people who play golf.
Well, we're going to give out SAT exams a little later. Yeah. So how many play golf?
17 million people play golf. The subscription, the paid subscription rate to Golf Digest is 2.2 million people. So obviously it's a small and extremely enthusiastic core of people in this country that are just crazy for the game of golf, and it's not something that you can begin to understand until you try to play the game. I think part of the charm and the appeal of the game is in its inherent difficulty. It looks so simple, and it is so difficult, as Solzhenitsyn said of golf: I tried, I swung, I missed, I never tried again. And many people have taken that approach, and many, many more have not, and become completely infatuated with the game.
Tom Boswell has a new book about golf out. He's a sports writer, also writes about baseball and other sports. And he says that he thinks golf is the least commercialized of all sports today. And I wonder if you'd agree with that.
Well, in one sense, definitely not, because the structure of these tournament golf from a week-to-week basis is completely corporately oriented. All golf tournaments these days, or virtually all golf tournaments, have corporate sponsors: AT&T, Kemper Insurance, insurance companies in Houston, banks in New York, manufacturers Hanover.
And the name is frequently on the tour, right?
The name is part of the tour name. So in that sense, no, I wouldn't agree with them. And no, I wouldn't agree with that assessment, really, because the equipment is the equipment that the players use becomes endorsements and advertisements immediately afterwards. The balls they use, the clothes they wear, and I think golf is a very corporately oriented game in America in a leisurely way, and it is in a tournament way as well.
As far as I can tell, there are two main kinds of tours. One is the corporate or commercially sponsored tour, like the Honda Classic, mm-hmm. and the other is the celebrity tour, like the Bob Hope Classic and the Sammy Davis Jr. Tour.
Right.
I wonder if you have a sense of what the golf pros think of the celebrities, like the Bob Hopes and the Sammy Davises who run the tours.
Yeah, well, they're pretty grateful to him by and large, because that's how they make their living. There are these terms you're referring to have several days of what are known as pro-ams that precede the tournament, and celebrities and businessmen of of all flavors, paid great sums of money to play, to have the privilege of playing with these professional golfers, and that's really where the purse for the entire tournament comes from. So, even though they might grumble some about the poor quality of Sammy Davis Jr.'s game, they're really quite grateful to his presence and his enthusiasm for it, because it's directly responsible for their livelihood.
You worked for, I forget, one of the networks, was it CBS?
Mm-hmm.
Spotting the ball for their golf broadcast. What do you have to do when you do that?
A caddy who somehow winds up without a bag at a particular tournament is often given 1 week's worth of employment by the network that's broadcasting that particular week's tournament, and that's frequently ABC or CBS. And what a spotter does is gets up in the broadcast booth with the announcer and tells the announcer what club a particular player is using, how far he is from the particular hole, and the announcer relays that information to the millions of people who are watching tournaments.
Is it fun to do?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, but it's not what a caddy most wants to be doing. The TV broadcasts come up on the weekends, and caddies are, it's probably one of the few professions where a caddy really wants to be working on a weekend, because if he's not working on a weekend, he's not making any significant amount of money.
You know what I find entertaining about golf broadcasts? It's the only kind of sport, I just find this ironic, it's the only kind of sport that I can think of where there isn't somebody getting very excited and shouting with a lot of energy in their description of what's happening. It's all in a very hushed tone, in a whisper.
Yeah.
Golf is, for outsiders, one of the most polite games, and I wonder if it's actually that way once you're inside.
There's a fair amount of gamesmanship in golf when two players wind up in a playoff after 72 holes, and the way they address one another and the courtesies they extend to one another, one sees a fair amount of gamesmanship in that. But by and large, I think that golf is as polite and as gracious a game as it appears to be from the outside. Golf is, I think, the only sport that I can think of off the top of my head where there's no official monitoring play at all times, and golfers will frequently call penalties on themselves that they and only they see. And U.S. Opens have been sacrificed because of players calling penalties on themselves, and that's really the underlying basis of the game, is that there's this rule book, and that it's a Bible of the game. And if the game is going to be played with spirit and the way it was meant to be played, then that rule book has to be followed absolutely to the T. And if it's not, the whole game is demeaned, and then it's meaningless, and there's no point being out there. And that's one of the reasons why professional golfers and top amateurs have a very difficult time playing with people who are struggling with the game, because these people don't play with that same spirit.
There are two books that I know of now out about golf, yours and Tom Boswell's new book about golf. And I'm not familiar with a large work of golf writing. Is it much of a literary sport? Has there been much really good golf writing?
Yeah, I guess you haven't heard Plimpton's claim about sports writing as it relates to books. It's his small ball theory. The smaller the ball gets, the better the writing gets. So therefore, you have almost no good books about basketball, with the exception of maybe that one that Halberstam wrote, and quite a few more good books about baseball, and then an enormous number of good books about golf, which is perhaps one of the smaller balls used for a sport. There is an extremely rich tradition of excellent, truly excellent golf writing that probably began with a man named Bernard Darwin, who was the grandson of the great naturalist Charles Darwin, who wrote for the Times of London, and his golf accounts were really small essays. And golfers at the time were fond of saying, "I never really know how I played until I read Bernard Darwin's account of my play in the following day's Times." And Bernard Darwin is just one of the people, probably the most prominent golf writer today, is a man named Herbert Warren Wind, who is a New Yorker writer and a founding editor of Sports Illustrated, who is, he's about 70 years old, and he's been writing about golf since about 1938 and has seen most of the greats come and go, and writes with an incredibly deep historic perspective. He's known all the top players since Walter Hagen's time, and he writes with a real poetic quality about a very poetic game, and his essays, which are collected regularly, are things that will last forever, I think.
You mentioned the smaller the ball, the better the writing, and I'm trying to think of terrific writing about ping pong, which has a yet smaller ball. But I guess
we'll be waiting.
Every
for
theory
that.
Has a hole in it. Well, you're back to your original career of reporting. You're a sports writer now at the Philadelphia Inquirer. You got some interesting advice when you were starting this book about golf. You were visiting with William Shawn, who was then the editor of the New Yorker magazine. What kind of advice did he give you about writing this book?
What Mr. Shawn said was that the idea was a good one and that it was a lark. People don't expect that college-educated English majors who are interested in pursuing newspaper careers are going to drop off the face of the earth for half a year or so to become a caddy on the pro golf tour. It's something that a lot of people might fantasize about. It's something that very few people have done. And that if in the writing you can celebrate the lark of this, you'll have a good book in your hand. He said, don't take yourself too seriously and just enjoy yourself on the tour and enjoy yourself in the writing. And that's what I tried to do.
And no doubt you did enjoy yourself the 6 months that you caddied.
That's fantastic. It's a fantasy.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking with us about
it. Thanks for having me.
My guest has been sports writer Michael Bamberger. His account of his experiences as a caddy on the Pro Golf Tour is titled The Green Road Home, and it's published by Contemporary Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next program, I'll talk with novelist and record producer Sam Charters. During the 1950s, Charters traveled through the South making field recordings of previously unknown blues musicians and singers. Many of those recordings are now in the Folkway record catalog. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, comic Graham Chapman talks about his years with the British comedy group Monty Python's Flying Circus. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Grammy Award winner Whitney Houston. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Full Metal Jacket, the latest in a growing list of movies about the Vietnam War, this one by director Stanley Kubrick. And we have an update on the day's news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. It's time for the news. This is Fresh Air. In the couple of years since Whitney Houston's first album was released, she's won 8 major music awards, plus a 1986 Emmy for her performance on the previous year's Grammy Award program. The 23-year-old singer from New Jersey has a new record out. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has this review.
The number one song in the country these days is Whitney Houston's I Wanna Dance With Somebody. The number one album in the country is Houston's latest, called Whitney. It's a Whitney world. Billboard magazine reports that this Whitney album is the first time a female pop artist has released an album that entered the music charts at number one. You're public radio folks, so maybe you're not really interested in this commercial music biz stuff, I know. But I've taken it as my little mission here to keep you connected to the real world. I'm telling you all this so you'll have some perspective when I play this big hit that may have passed you by entirely. Here's Whitney Houston and I Wanna Dance With Somebody.
When the night falls, my lonely heart calls. Oh. Whitney Houston and her number one hit, I Wanna Dance With Somebody. As an artist, Whitney Houston isn't particularly interesting. Her voice was trained singing gospel music, but it's a puffed-up, powerful instrument without an awful lot of expression. Then, too, her songs are either wispy little things or big, bombastic showstoppers. Either way, not the stuff of greatness. But Whitney Houston is a very interesting pop phenomenon. For one thing, she's young, in her early 20s, but she comes out of a very clearly defined musical tradition. It's one that hasn't been especially popular in recent years. She's a soul singer, capable of delivering the sort of lively rhythm and blues you just heard, or torchy ballads that haven't been pop hits since the heyday of Dionne Warwick and Aretha Franklin in the 60s. Her singing lacks the indelible stamp of great ones like Warwick and Aretha. Warwick, by the way, is Houston's cousin. Houston's mother is the gospel singer Sissy Houston, so Whitney is steeped in the history of this kind of music. This sort of pop singing has made a comeback in recent years in the music of Sade, Anita Baker, and lately Regina Bell. But Houston is easily the most successful at it, without ever imprinting her music with as much personality as the singers I've just named. Nonetheless, at a time when the rest of the top ten is filled with the aggressive sounds of heavy metal and rap music, Whitney Houston's airy pop is being sought after as something, an oasis, a relief, an excuse, a retreat. Since the skinny songs on her new album Whitney are even more mediocre than the slender ones on her debut album released last year, it'll be interesting to see whether her popularity remains as pervasive as it's been. Right now, however, her voice is the one America wants to hear more than any other.
Our rock critic Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Whitney Houston's new album called Whitney.
Make sure everything goes right, and you find you've only wound up with a mess. It's a common situation, even though you feel abandoned and alone.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is comic Graham Chapman. Chapman was a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus, the six-man British comedy group which broke up audiences at home and abroad with their performances on TV, films, and records. The Pythons created a comic style based on surrealistic wordplay. Chapman was memorable in some of the group's classic sketches.
I'd like to have an argument, please.
Certainly, sir. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't. This is my first time.
I see. Well, do you want to have just one argument, or were you thinking of taking a course?
Well, what is the cost?
Well, it's £1 for a 5-minute argument, but only £8 for a course of 10.
Well, I think it would be best if I perhaps started off with just the one and then see how it goes.
Fine. Well, I'll see who's free at the moment. Mr. DeBakey's free, but he's a little bit conciliatory. Ah, yes. Try Mr. Barnard, room 12.
Thank you.
What do you want?
Well, I was told outside that...
Don't give me that, you snotty-faced heap of parrot droppings!
What?
Shut your festering gob, you tit! Your type really makes me puke, you vacuous, toffee-nosed, malodorous pervert!
Look, I came here for an argument. I'm not going to just...
Oh! Oh, I'm sorry, but this is abuse.
Oh, I see. Well, that explains...
Ah, yes. You want room 12A, just along the corridor.
Oh, thank you very much. Sorry.
Not at all.
Thank you.
Stupid git.
That was Graham Chapman dishing out the abuse. In addition to being an inspired comic writer and actor, Chapman is a trained physician, a gay rights activist, and a recovering alcoholic. If you've lost track of him since the group split up, he's been a stand-up comic, a lecturer, author, and film producer. I asked Chapman if his early TV sketches with Monty Python were considered too risque or eccentric.
Well, the BBC, to begin with, didn't like us very much, which was actually strangely in our favour, because they therefore they put us out at a very unpopular hour of the evening, late on a Sunday night, which is not a top slot in Britain. Also, they frequently preempted us with important things like horse show jumping. They generally didn't rate us very highly, which was good because that meant they didn't even bother to read the scripts. So that meant we could do more or less as we wanted. It wasn't until towards the end of the second series of programmes that they began to realise that we were picking up quite an audience. And then, of course, they began to read the scripts, and that did lead to one or two problems. Naughty words, really. Just silly, childish, naughty words that they would find objectionable, I suppose, because they probably had a problem with their early toilet training, the BBC.
That must be it.
Yes, I think so. Found sensitive areas. But we had then a sort of precedent to point to. We could say, but we said that in programme 3 or whatever, and they would listen to it and found out that we had, and that they had no complaints. And so, you know, we could say, we can say it again then.
I think that there's a lot of British humour and Monty Python-type humour that a lot of Americans don't necessarily get because the language is so different?
Yes, I suppose there are. Although we were quite fortunate in that respect, in that during the whole TV series, we tended not, on the whole, to use topical humour. So that has meant that it is relatively timeless, at least, although there obviously are one or two specific things that that will be pretty meaningless now. And also, because of the area and where we were filming or where we were performing these sketches and the local dialects, things might be at first pretty meaningless to an American audience, we imagine certainly. But they seem to pick up on it and to persist and indeed find translations if they can't understand them first off.
There's never been any that I know of women in the group.
Well, there was Carol Cleveland, who used to play the female roles when we needed a real female.
Was it more fun to have the men play the women than get women in the group?
Not so much the fun. It was cheaper. That was the most important factor. There were just six of us involved with the programme, writing it and performing it on the whole. And the BBC, as I said before, didn't like us very much. They didn't give us a very large budget. So we had to try and keep casting down to a minimum. We played, therefore, as many roles as we could ourselves.
You have been a gay rights activist and, I think, edited a gay paper, journal.
I didn't edit it. What I did really was just to provide them with a little bit of cash in the early days so that they could get a newspaper started. There was a kind of collective which formed a newspaper called Gay News.
Was there the group was comfortable with you coming out publicly?
John Cleese was rather surprised, to say the least. And in fact, I think I mentioned it to his girlfriend first. She was happy about it, but John was rather surprised. I think Jonathan Miller summed that up, John surprised, by saying that he thought it was a bit unfair of me. After all, I was a pipe-smoking, rugby-playing mountaineer, not the obvious sort of gay person, I suppose. So it was a surprise for him. But I think he understood in the end.
A lot of the men in the group dressed in drag for certain roles.
Yes, which is actually not all that unusual in Britain, certainly. I mean, a long tradition of it going right back to Shakespeare and so on, so it didn't seem like anything particularly extraordinary.
Did people interpret that as being gay humour at all, to have men in drag?
No, it worried people in the States a little bit to begin with. I think there's a certain sensitivity because, of course, the United States male on the whole is very much more bothered about whether he's being butch enough and macho enough, you know. There's less of, I think, people are a bit more relaxed about that sort of thing in Europe, really. They're not so worried about their masculinity because they know it's there, so they don't have to prove it all the time.
Well, what's your collaborating method when you are working together?
John and I wrote together. Michael Payne and Terry Jones wrote together. Eric wrote on his own, and then Terry Gilliam did all the animations and the visual side of things.
So would you lock yourself up in a room and try to write sketches together?
Yeah, well, John and I would just meet up and sit there for an hour or so, trying to avoid work at all costs, drinking cups of coffee and reading the newspapers, talking about what was in the news, maybe anything to put off that awful moment of having to put something on paper. And then about an hour before lunchtime, we'd begin to feel guilty that we hadn't done anything, and at that point we would hopefully think of something which had either occurred during that first hour or so, or if not, then in desperation, open up Roger's thesaurus and simply look at a collection of words to see if that inspired anything, which it sometimes did.
I'll bet it did, because so many of her sketches were wordplay, and it wasn't logical, but it was hysterical.
Look at the cheese shop sketch, for instance.
Oh, and the cheese
almost
dancing.
almost directly from Roger's thesaurus.
What did you look up that led to that?
Well, we were into cheeses anyway, so we simply looked at that point. We liked the idea of a shop which contained absolutely nothing that it claimed it sold, which is just a minor exaggeration of the way some British shops are. So that was what we were getting at, I think, and decided on cheese as being the comestible in point, and so just looked up a whole list of cheeses in Roger, added a few, and there it was.
Gouda?
No.
Edam?
No.
Caithness?
No.
Smoked Austrian?
No.
Japanese Sage Derby?
No, sir.
You do have some cheese, do you?
Of course, sir. It's a cheese shop, sir. We got...
No, don't tell me. I'm keen to guess.
Fair enough.
Wensleydale?
Yes.
Ah, well, I'll have some of that.
Oh, I thought you were talking to me, sir. Mr. Wensleydale, that's my name.
Greek feta?
Not as such.
Gorgonzola?
No.
Parmesan?
No.
Mozzarella? Pepper crema? No. Danish pizza.
When you're a comic writer and you're writing with a collaborator, do you laugh at each other's funny lines?
Yes, and also laugh together, too. I mean, there's one whole sketch when John and I, we perhaps had gone a bit too far, but we felt guilty about it while we were writing it, which made us laugh hysterically. And that was the Undertaker's sketch. I mean, perhaps we had gone too far. You know, people taking their dead mothers into Undertakers in a sack, you know, it's on sort of tricky ground, isn't it?
And then they had to decide if they were going to burn them,
bury them,
or dump them.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. That made us feel guilty, I suppose, because all the time we were thinking of our own dear mothers, and it is a bit far to go, isn't it?
Well, this is a real serious issue, I think. If you're writing humor like that, do you want your mother to hear it?
No, you know, fortunately, with John and I, we did frequently, I suppose, really think of our own mothers when we were writing sketches. John always used the excuse that it was my mother, and I always used the excuse that it was his. And they seemed to believe that quite satisfactorily.
Are you still collaborating with John Cleese now?
Yes, I mean, it's been some 27 years now, on and off. I mean, there have been huge patches where we've been doing other things individually. But, yeah.
So are there more movies in the works?
Well, there's nothing in the works at the moment as a group. No, we're all doing our own individual things. But I think we're all optimistic that there will be another movie at some point. But the difficult thing is getting six people to agree on a subject. It really is quite tricky.
Graham Chapman is a founding member of Monty Python's Flying Circus. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following today?
Well, a new argument, Terry, today in the reflagging debate. Some experts are saying that there are now so many factions in Iran that it's hard to predict how that country would react if the U.S. were to put its flags on Kuwaiti ships in the Persian Gulf. Also, we're going to be hearing voices from the Appalachian Trail. It's the longest continuously marked footpath in the world, 2,100 miles from Georgia to Maine. And a small mystery for those of you, anyway, who don't know Morse code.
I know, that's the Morse lyrics to the All Things Considered theme, right?
Close. You'll find out tonight.
Okay, those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Full Metal Jacket is director Stanley Kubrick's new film about the war in Vietnam. It's his first film since The Shining, which was released in 1980. The screenplay for Full Metal Jacket was written by Kubrick, along with Michael Herr, author of the Vietnam novel Dispatches, and Gustav Hasford, whose book The Short Timers was the basis for the movie. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
Full Metal Jacket is a failure, but it's a very smart failure. So smart, in fact, that it may leave most of its audience in the dust, dazedly wondering what just hit them and why. The movie's divided into three chapters: a long sojourn in a Marine boot camp, a short midsection about the beginnings of the Tet Offensive, and a harrowing, beautifully shot final sequence amid the ruins of Hue, in which an American squadron is almost destroyed by an unseen sniper. What connects the parts is the brutal education of Private Joker, played by Matthew Modine, who gives an unexciting but quietly competent performance. In the first and best sequence, we watch basic training turn him into a lean, mean fighting machine, at the expert hands of a drill sergeant, played by the real-life ex-drill sergeant Lee Ermey.
Anybody know who Lee Harvey Oswald was? Private Snowball.
Sir, he shot Kennedy, sir!
250 feet. He was 250 feet away and shooting at a moving target. Oswald got off three rounds with an old Italian bolt-action rifle in only 6 seconds and scored two hits, including a headshot. Do any of you people know where these individuals learned how to shoot? Private Joker.
Sir, in the Marines, sir!
In the Marines, outstanding. Those individuals showed what one motivated Marine and his rifle can do. And before you ladies leave my island, you will all be able to do the same thing.
That's a darkly funny scene. In fact, the boot camp sequence is expertly handled. Director Stanley Kubrick wants us to see that the military system is turning these young Marines into efficient killers by twisting their sexuality. They learn to call their guns by their girlfriends' names, and every soft or compassionate or caring impulse is pummeled out of them until only the aggression remains. To understand what Kubrick's getting at in this movie, you have to take seriously the line they're using in the film's ads: "Vietnam can kill me, but it can't make me care." To Kubrick, it was that very attitude, ground into every soldier from the moment he entered boot camp, that defeated America in Vietnam. We were cynical, uncaring death machines, which made us no match for a nation truly committed to a cause. In Full Metal Jacket, we soon discover that all that hard Marine Corps masculinity can be defeated by a single, powerfully devoted warrior, and it doesn't even have to be a man. That's not an unintelligent message for a Vietnam movie to purvey, but it's not exactly fresh news either. In fact, a lot of the material in Full Metal Jacket feels like nicely photographed old hat. Even the long-awaited climax will look disappointingly familiar to anyone who's seen Apocalypse Now. But that isn't the worst of it. In order to make us feel anything about what's happening in this movie, Kubrick would have to involve us in his characters. And like most of his films, Full Metal Jacket has none. Stanley Kubrick may be the most misanthropic major director the movies have ever seen. He doesn't seem to like people. And when his movies are about a world of madmen or machines, like Dr. Strangelove or 2001, that can be effective. But if you're telling a story about how the military dehumanizes, it helps to have some humans on hand to dehumanize. And that's Full Metal Jacket's big bugaboo. The dialogue is so stylized, the humor so clipped and black and metallic, and the message so poundingly pervasive that there's no room to get to know anybody, not even a little. Full Metal Jacket has sound and fury to burn, but you'll listen in vain for the simple beating of a human heart.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a preview of our next program. On our next show, I'll speak with New Yorker magazine fashion writer Kennedy Fraser. Her new book is titled Scenes from the Fashionable World. Also, Marty Gross will return to demonstrate his rhythm guitar style. And Ken Tucker will review two classic films now on home video, both directed by Preston Sturges. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. We want to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WUWF in Pensacola, Florida. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.